All right, let's get started. So tonight's actually pretty appropriate for our learning to be right before Hanukkah. I guess it would be even more appropriate if it was next Tuesday, which is the first, is that the first night of Hanukkah?
Tuesday.
It is the first night, okay. Because the Greeks get a lot of airtime this time of year. The Greeks. We're going to be talking a lot about Greeks tonight. So we'll get into it a little bit more specifically, but it seems when we talk about Jews and the wisdom of the other, that a lot of rabbinic ink was spilled talking about Chachma Yevanit, or the wisdom of the Greeks. Not just the wisdom of the Greeks, but even the language of the Greeks is something that gets a lot of airplay or airtime in rabbinic writing, and we'll try to figure out why that's the case, because I think that's one of the bigger questions. Before we ask why is that the case, we should probably know what the case is. So we'll start with that. And when we get to kind of a halachic debate or different sources on different sides of the same issue, we'll try to understand what some of the reasoning behind it might be. And finally, at the end of the night, kind of a modern approach to the wisdom of the other from one, at least, Orthodox approach to the questions. So, to go into this conversation about the wisdom of the other, it kind of has has an elephant in the room, which is before we can even talk about, does Judaism value other people's thoughts or writings, the question before that is, well, does Judaism ever give us permission, quote, space, does the Torah give us space to exempt ourselves from our own wisdom? So as we kind of continue to go through the tensions between particularism and universalism, being open to the other, but also being kind of committed to ourselves, one question that starts out this conversation is, well, if you have enough time to go study other people's wisdom, or to go to an art museum and look at a piece of, a piece of sculpture from 2,000 years ago that's going back to Greek or Roman times, well, then the time you're spending to go to the museum or the time you're spending to go study Western literature is time that you're not studying Torah. And so that's kind of the first piece of our puzzle tonight. What I kind of framed in this source sheet is, go find a time that is neither day nor night. Because that's actually one of the responses that we have in our tradition for when you're allowed to go study Chachma Yevanit, Greek wisdom. So just like it's a great response. I feel like it's an early, the Yiddish expressions of finding a fun way to say something, or you're making your points without absolutely saying it. I feel like this is like the Gemara's version of that. So where does this obligation to study Torah come from, or the obligation to study Torah incessantly, without stopping, without interrupting it? If you haven't yet looked at your source sheet, what might be an example of a commitment to constant Torah study? The Shema, great. So we'll read the Shema together in a minute, or at least the opening of the Shema. There's a verse in the Shema that seems to imply that very much. There's a verse in Joshua that we'll get to after that takes what you think, once you read the Shema, you think, okay, well, there's a pretty extensive obligation to study Torah, but then there's a verse in Joshua where Joshua, in the first chapter, right after Moses dies, has a conversation with God, and God basically tells him that you have to do even more than that, it seems. And then beyond that, in our tradition, in our rabbinic tradition, there's the concept that Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam, that if you're going to weigh out all the mitzvot, which elsewhere, Ethics of Our Fathers tells us don't do that, don't ever weigh mitzvahs. But another Mishnah says that, a Braita says that you should weigh the mitzvahs, and Talmud Torah, the study of Torah, is Keneged, opposite, equal to, it's hard to translate it, Kulam, all the other commandments. So if you're going to take a scale and measure the weight of Torah, the Torah study, it's equivalent to everything else combined. So we very, very much value Torah study. There's a reason for, like it or not, like agree with it, disagree with it, that there's huge communities of Jews living in parts of America or parts of Israel, where specifically the men, but that's a different discussion for a different time. I'll have a class on men, women's, the development of women's leadership positions and women's relationship to mitzvot in a second series later on this year. But there's a reason why there are men who spend 10, 12, 14, 16, 18 hours a day studying Torah, it comes from within our tradition. So let's get started by reading the Shema and see where our rabbinic tradition takes that. Robin, do you want to start us off and we'll go in a counterclockwise circle?
Sure. From Devarim. Hear, yeah. O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord alone. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. Take to heart these instructions with which I charge you this day. Impress them upon your children. Recite them when you stay at home and when you are away, when you lie down and when you get up.
Okay. So it's that last verse that seems to give us a sense of timing of what, you know, from a chronological perspective, when should we be studying Torah? And the Shema tells us, b'shach b'cha, as you lie down, uv'kumech, and when you get up. So you should be involved in studying Torah at night and during the day. Okay. Let's take, we're going to skip source 2. Source 2 is a really early midrash. And if we had more time, we could kind of contrast the early rabbinic writing in the midrash to a later discussion in the Talmud. We're going to kind of simplify it and make it more of a flat discussion for tonight and just quote different opinions from within the Gemara itself, from within the Taz of the Talmud. So instead of like comparing and contrasting 100 versus 500 of the Common Era, we're just going to go to the 500. So you might think that you should be spending evening and morning studying Torah. We're also going to skip source 3, but if after source 4 I don't go back to 3, please remind me.
Source 3 is really interesting.
So it's interesting. It's going to be subsumed in source 4.
Okay.
You're going to see something really similar in source 4.
Okay.
So with that in mind, before we go into source 4, anyone who studied Talmud knows that it's associative thinking, right? So if you want to get to the meat of the subject you're actually interested in, you often have to start somewhere else. So the somewhere else that we're going to start is the obligation to have the lechem hapanim, the showbreads, removed once a week in the temple. Okay, so there's this kind of process, I think it's on Shabbat, where you take out the 12 showbreads that have this, were on the famous shulchan, on the famous table, you can find a picture of it somewhere in the Arskol Chumash, they would be removed and they'd be put back. And the question is...
Same ones or different ones?
Different ones.
Yeah.
Sorry,
okay.
Thanks. Not the same ones. You'd remove the old ones, you'd put in the new ones that were baked special for the occasion. And, hey guys, hey Steve, hey Rachel. I know, this Kumbaya setup I know makes life more complicated, but I appreciate you just indulging me. Yeah, we have some extra chairs, extra sword sheets. You guys can have one more. Okay, so when it comes to the showbread, here's the question that we're going to have for ourselves. The Torah in Shemot, in Exodus, says that it should be the showbreads in the temple should be lifanai tamid. Lifanai tamid means they should be in front of me always, constantly in front of me. So here, this is a very Jewish question. How always is always? How constant is constant to fulfill the obligation of these showbreads should always be in front of me? Specifically, there's going to be a moment when you take off the old ones before you can put in the new ones. So that's not tamid. That's not always. So how always is always? So that's going to be the beginning of our discussion. I'm going to break up volunteers to kind of read different pieces of Source 4. And I'm sorry it's not as pretty as some of the other Talmud translations I have here, but I had to copy it from another book because Sepharia has not yet gotten to their English translation of Menachot yet. So they're only halfway through the Talmud, so I had to find this one from somewhere else. Hank, do you want to start us off? And I'll ask you to pause a few lines down.
It was taught. Rabbi Yossi said, even if the old showbread was taken away in the morning and the new was set down in the evening, there is no harm. How then am I to explain the verse, before me continually, the table should not remain overnight without bread?
Okay.
Rabbi Amos.
Pause there. Sorry. Okay. That's pause number one. So how do you fulfill the obligation of these showbreads should be in front of me constantly? That you shouldn't go a whole night without the bread being replaced. So even if it's gone for a few hours, that's fine as long as it's there, you know, for an entire day and at least part of the night. Okay. We have a similar thing in the temple with at least one other mitzvah that I can think about, and that's the menorah. So we're talking a lot about Hanukkah tonight. We'll get to the Greeks later, and for now we're talking about the menorah. The menorah has, what's the obligation in the Torah? I'm forgetting the exact verse in the Torah right now. That ner tamid, right, that you should have a ner tamid, a constant flame lit in the temple, lo tichbat, but you should not extinguish it. And the Gemara asks, well, one second, these candles are going to go out at some point. And specifically, we also know you have to actually clean them out. The Kohanim had to clean them out every morning. So how do you define something as tamid? And the answer that the Gemara says is as long as it's relit every day, as long as it's lit for part of the day, that's called tamid, that's called always. So now let's take these kinds of precedents where tamid always doesn't actually always mean always. That's not confusing. It's a bit of a tongue twister. Always doesn't always mean always. And apply that to a presumption that there is a constant always obligation to study Torah. And we'll kind of work our way into that. How always is that mitzvah? How constant is that mitzvah? So Hank, thank you for reading. I'm going to ask Claire, can you take it up from Rabbi Ami? Rabbi Ami? Okay. So thanks, Claire. I mentioned before that there's going to be a verse in Joshua that expands the original Torah obligation. So this full verse, and I should have quoted it separately, is that Lo Yamush at Sefer Torah Hazeh Mipicha, that this book should not leave your mouth. And then it says V'yigita Bam Yoma V'layla, and you should engage in it day and night. So it's kind of an expansion of the original verse in the Torah. You should be doing it day and night, but not only that, it should never leave your mouth. Right? It's as in there's a constant obligation. So now, Claire, now that you read the rest of the Talmud, we're saying, I see with the showbread that always doesn't always mean always. Mm-hmm. Right? And the same might apply to the study of Torah. How do you fulfill the constant obligation of Torah according to Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Yossi?
Bookends.
Study one chapter of Torah in the morning, one chapter of Torah in the evening, and you fulfilled your mitzvah. We're going to now quote Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who's a famous rabbi of the Mishnah, and he, I don't know if he makes it, contracts the mitzvah even more, but he makes it a little more like tangible for us. And beyond that, it's funny because it's possible we shouldn't all be studying this in the first place. The lines we're about to learn now, some people would say you're actually not allowed to learn. So we're going to go into that. Jonah, do you want to take us from Rabbi Yochanan?
Yeah. Rabbi Yochanan said in the name of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, even though a man only reads the Shema in the morning and evening, he has thereby fulfilled the precept of shall not depart.
Okay. So just pausing for a second. How do you fulfill your constant obligation of Torah study? Just davening.
In the morning.
Right. Just by davening. And it's possible, you know, we know that Tefillah, prayer as we think about it today, being like a very set up process in the Siddur, that developed over time. But the original biblical commandment of davening was debated as to what it is, but at least there's a commandment to read it in the morning and then to read it to read Shema in the morning and the night. And Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai goes so far as to say that doesn't only fulfill your obligation to just say the Shema, that also fulfills your obligation to study Torah. Do you want to just read the next sentence also?
It is forbidden, however, to say this in the presence of an Amharis.
Okay. So, what's forbidden? It's a little. The language here is a little unclear. There, halachically, you can fulfill your obligation of Torah study by just saying the Shema in the morning and the night. However, don't spread it. Don't tell people. Just kind of an odd thing to say. Who's an Amharis? Literally, Amharis. I didn't translate it because it's a good expression to be familiar with. Means a person of the land.
Yeah.
So what that exactly means, it means someone who's not overly erudite, someone who's not a great scholar. You know, these are the people working the fields, literally. So it's the normal, it's the worker bees. Not the intellectual elite. So it's kind of ironic now that you think about it. The intellectual elite, the ones who are actually learned, can fulfill their obligation of study by just doing a little bit in the morning and the night. But Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is saying, for the people who are actually not learned, you should make them think that they should be studying all day long. It's
so
just
it's not the other. It's not a matter of not Jews. Don't say in the presence of non-Jews. They're even saying that's much more elitist to say don't
yeah.
say it in the presence of the unlearned, even if they're Jewish.
Yeah. Well, we haven't got it in this source. Jonah, I think, read ahead in source 2, the Midrash, which kind of combines an obligation to never not be studying Torah together with, well, what happens if you're not studying Torah? Then you might start studying other things or getting involved in other matters. Mm-hmm. So we're not there yet. That's coming up later in this verse. Before we get there, we're going to see Rabba Discree and Jonah. I'll ask you to read this last line, and then we'll pause, and we'll actually move on to the next person.
But Rabba says, it is a mitzvah to say it in the presence of an Amoraim.
So this law that you can basically fulfill your obligation of Torah study by reading Shema in the morning and the night, you know what? It's actually a good thing. Let everyone know. don't be so heavy on the Jewish guilt, right? Let people know that it's you can fulfill the mitzvah in a more basic way, and that's fine. This gets quoted, I think, in the Gemara and Brachot as well. So what's the possibility here? Like, what's the concern? So the later rabbis developed this phrase called bitul Torah. Bitul Torah is, there's probably a good English equivalent, means the cancellation or the lacking of Torah. There's basically, and if you go to a yeshiva setting, this becomes like this becomes a weekly conversation that some rabbi is going to come up and give a schmooze, like give a big speech about the perils of bitul Torah. That's basically when you have free time and you don't use it to study. And it becomes like, it's one of like the predominant themes in a lot of yeshiva circles. Like, if you have free time, you should be studying Torah, yomam v'layla, day and night. There's a story of, I think, a contemporary rabbi who made a siyum on the Talmud. I forget who this was, but I've heard it as a true story. Made a siyum on the Talmud. But he's one of these exceptional rabbis who studied the Talmud many, many times in his life. And so one of his students asked him, like, what are you talking? Like, why are you making such a big party for this siyum? Haven't you done it numerous times before? And his response was, that's true, but this is the time that I finished the Talmud just waiting for the bus. I had I had these like little volumes, and I carried them everywhere I went. And when I was waiting at bus stops, I made a siyum on the entire Talmud. That's like a value that is, we probably don't speak about it so often. I'm probably guilty of this myself, that sometimes I come home at night, and instead of opening up a Torah book, I've been known to watch the occasional TV show. It caught me red-handed. But there really is a value of Talmud, Torah, Keneged Kulam. Torah study is more important, or as important as everything else combined. Okay, so when that happens, and now that we're in the conversation of how much Torah we're obligated to study, there's a smart aleck known as Ben Dama, the son of Rabbi Shmuel's sister, who asks his uncle, Ellen, do you want to take us up from there?
So Ben Dama, the son of Rabbi Shmuel's sister, once asked Rabbi Shmuel, may one such as I, who has studied the whole of the Torah, learn Greek wisdom. He thereupon read to him the following verse. This book of the law shall not depart out of your mouth, but you shall meditate upon it day and night. Go then and find a time that is neither day nor night, and learn the Greek wisdom.
Okay. So the question is, I'm a scholar, right? Maybe I'm the kind of person who can actually fulfill Torah study just by reading the Shema in the morning and the night, because I've done it all already. And so maybe I should be exempt from having to study Torah all the time, because I've done it already. I've learned all there is to learn. I studied every book of the Bible with all the commentaries, and then I moved on to Mishnah and Talmud and Midrash and all the commentaries on that, and then I learned all the halacha codes, and I'm the man. I've done it all. And so can I now be exempt? And the answer that Rabbi Shmuel gives is, sure. The obligation in the book of Joshua is that these words should never part your mouth, neither day nor night. So find a time that's neither day nor night, and then go study Greek wisdom. Okay, so here's where Chachma Yivani, Greek wisdom, maybe loosely translated as Greek philosophy, right? Plato, Aristotle. What room is there for that in our tradition? If you ask Rabbi Shmuel, not a whole lot. Right? If you can, it's the equivalent of like if only there was a 25th hour in the day, right? If you could find that extra hour, then go ahead. But until then, you're not exempt.
But
you have to keep setting.
It was also about the person who was asking
mm-hmm.
and his arrogance.
Okay.
And he checked him, like, he bettered him. It's like, so he quoted something, and he's like, so go find that, so.
Yeah, like, you think you're all that, I bet you could do better, or?
Well, no, he was, like, taking his own line of argument and checked him.
By,
as they say in the vernacular.
Okay, well, cool. So there's definitely some arrogance going on there. And I think, right, to assume that you've studied all there is to study about Torah, I think in the rabbinic mind is definitely arrogant. If we're going to take one thing out of the class today, it's that we don't see, there might be value to other wisdom, but we don't see Torah as the same as other wisdom. It exists on a different sphere, on a different plane. And if you were to say that you've mastered Torah, on some level, is almost to say like you've mastered God. Mm-hmm. That's a presumption that we don't really want to make. On the other hand, though, this opinion that you can never be exempt from studying Torah and therefore there's never a time for the study of anything else is only one of two opinions in the Gemara. And so the next line, Ellen, do you want to finish us off with that paragraph?
Go then and find a time that is neither day or night and learn the Greek wisdom. This, however, is at odds with the view of Rabbi Shimon Bar Nachmani. For Rabbi Shimon Bar Nachmani said in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, this verse is neither duty nor not command, but a blessing.
Okay. So that's hard to understand on its own. What he's basically saying is that verse from Joshua that you thought is the commandment to never be doing anything but studying the Torah in any of your free time. By the way, that's actually not an obligation. That's a blessing that's given to Joshua because he's dedicated his life to Torah. So don't read it as an obligation, but rather you, Yehoshua, who have dedicated yourself to this, you'll be blessed to study Torah day and night and not have to do anything else. I don't know if that ever happens, but it's kind of a nice way to think about retirement. Right? Okay, so there's already kind of two views within this Gemara, and if you want to see an earlier source that parses out the same tension, you can look back to source 2 later on your own. I said I was going to get to source 3. So this is actually a famous line in the Hebrew. I'm going to read it in Hebrew, and then I'll ask Rachel if you can read it in English. So we're going to go back to source 3. Whereas the Gemara seems to at least have one line of thinking that there's never an appropriate time for Greek learning, for Greek wisdom. What's the Hebrew there is Chachma Yivani, the Greek wisdom. The Midrash in source 3 has a kind of a bifurcation of when is there value to the wisdom of others and when is there not value to the wisdom of others. And there's a famous line, Im Yomar Lecha Adam, if a person tells you, Yesh Chachma Bagoyim, that there is wisdom among the nations, what should your response be? Ta'amin. You should believe them, or you should believe that wisdom. So that's a famous line, it's kind of quoted on occasion in Hebrew, Chachma Bagoyim Ta'amin, wisdom in the nations should be believed. You should believe it. Yeah, I think in other versions it has a yud after.
Oh, it does?
Yeah, but I hear you. I think in some other versions it has a yud. On the other hand, Yesh Torah Bagoyim, if someone tells you that there is Torah knowledge among the nations, Al Ta'amin, don't believe it. So there are some things that you should be interested in learning more about from among the nations, other things you shouldn't. Here's like, it's a great example of where the particularism and the universalism are clashing with each other. Right? We're open to the wisdom, the general wisdom of the world, but not for the wisdom of the world that tries to tell us how to understand our own particular kind of body of Torah and wisdom and Dvar Hashem, the Word of God. Okay, but herein lies the problem. That Rabbi Ishmael says that you should never spend time studying the wisdom of the Greeks. But on the other hand, the Midrash says it's good to believe it. So how do you believe something that you don't know? And so that's what I kind of want to work on today. You know, what do the rabbis think about Greek wisdom, about general wisdom? You can call it philosophy. What I didn't go into today is science, because it's something I've done in other places and I don't think there's as much, at least when it comes to like the pure sciences, like back in the times of the Gemara, astrology is one of those. Astrology is the scientific one. I always mix up astrology and astronomy. Astronomy is the scientific one?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so astronomy. That the Gemara already takes for granted is actually an obligation for Jews to study, because if you don't study astronomy, then what can't you do?
Pray.
Tell time. If you can't tell time, you can't... Right. You can't tell the months. You can't serve any. You can't celebrate Yom Tov. You can't celebrate the holidays. You can't celebrate the Rosh Hashanah, the beginning of the year, if you don't know when the beginning of the year is. And so the Gemara interprets that there's actually an obligation to study astronomy. Science is less controversial. It seems to be taken for granted that you should know how, to the extent possible, that how our bodies work, what are kind of considered to be cures and non-cures. There's a whole question about when there's kind of when there's medical recommendations in the Talmud, you know, that generally don't check out with modern medicine. How do we think of those? Okay, we could spend another class talking about that. But that's not our... Yeah.
We should be able to read Aristotle and Plato, but we ought not be reading all the stories of Greek mythology.
So, you know, there's actually a statement in the Midrash that the students, some students in the Beit Midrash were actually studying the works of Homer, which I think are actually stories about different mythologies and gods. I never saw that. They didn't specify.
Well, they talked about the gods.
More in the Iliad than the Odyssey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So we'll get there. Before we do that, though, there seems to be this rabbinic concern about Greek wisdom specifically. So let's kind of dig a little further into that. And if you go further, this is starting on page 2, it's not only the wisdom that seems to be forbidden.
Okay, thank you.
It doesn't seem to only be the wisdom. It might even be the language. Maybe there's a prohibition of studying Greek as a language, which is kind of seems to be coming out of nowhere, and I wanted to understand where that's coming from. So just for now, I'm going to read one line from the Mishnah in Sota. The Mishnah in Sota is source 5. It's the second line of the English that says that Bapumus shel Titus, during the war with Titus, here they translate it as Quietus. I don't know. I assume that's the same person. Mm-hmm. Titus is the Roman general who destroys the temple in 70 of the Common Era and later becomes the Roman emperor, which is why when he was marching back from Rome, from Jerusalem to Rome, I got to see it this summer as he went towards, I forget what that main plaza is, the Roman Forum. The Roman
Forum,
right.
Arch of Titus.
So they built to honor his conquest the Arch of Titus, which famously has a depiction on one of the reliefs of the Romans pillaging the temple or taking back all the ruins from the temple.
The menorah is very prominent.
Yeah, the menorah is prominent. Did it ever get there? Question for another time. Okay. But during that war, the Jews who were living at the time, so that's we're talking about the Mishnaic period, the period where you have the early rabbis of the Mishnah and 70 of the Common Era. So at some point during that war, they gazru al atrot kalot, they made a decree against the crowns worn by brides. Here's a little trivia information. Anyone know what those... Sorry. We actually have a very, very popular Israeli song that's based on this Mishnah.
Hmm.
The Talmud asks, what are these brides' crowns that we're talking about? And the answer is that the Gemara gives is that it is an ir shel zahav, a city made of gold. There was some kind of tiara or diadem that was basically, the way we understand it, was a depiction of Jerusalem made out of gold that brides would wear. And from there, Naomi Shemer got her song, Jerusalem of Gold, Yerushalayim Shel Zahav. So there's this kind of... we have references to this tiara in a few places. Here they said, you shouldn't wear it after this war. What's going on? Temple's destroyed. This is a very beautiful thing that would be worn at weddings. Or basically saying we should reduce our joy at weddings. You shouldn't wear this really beautiful tiara at weddings. The earlier set thing says that during an earlier war, they made grooms stop wearing some of their things too. Okay, but in addition to that, the shelo yilamed adam et beno yevanit, that no person should teach their child or their son here Greek. I found a source, I think in the Jerusalem Talmud that says that, I forget where, that maybe you shouldn't teach your son's Greek, but you should teach your daughter's Greek. Which parenthetically, you find some ultra-Orthodox communities nowadays where even where there's like a very strong feeling that boys should not study secular studies, there's much more of a push that the girls should. And I wonder if it's coming out of this. I'm not sure. In any case, you shouldn't teach your children Greek. What are we talking about, Greek the language or Greek the philosophy? And so for that, we have to go on to the Talmud that explains all of this. So we're now in source 6 in the Talmud. There's so much to talk about, and there's never enough time. You'll have to take my summary of this to say... That's a little crazy. There was basically a story that happened during the end of the Second Temple period. Jerusalem is under siege by the Romans. Even before that, there's basically pre-Roman time. We're back in the time of the Greeks. And who fought against the Greeks? Now, I told you we're going to get to Hanukkah. Who was the group of Jews who fought against the Greeks?
Hasmonians.
The Hasmoneans, Hashmonaim. And the Hasmoneans, you know, we think about the very short part of their history that worked out nicely, which is when they first beat the Greeks.
Yeah.
But there was like 200-300 years later where they basically turned into warring factions and had like internecide. Like they were basically fighting against each other and killing against each other. And the Gemara tells a story about two of these different leaders, the Hasmoneans, who are fighting against each other. One of them is inside the walls of Jerusalem, and they're being besieged by the others outside of the walls of Jerusalem. So it's turning into this internal fight. And despite that fight, though, they had a system where they would pull up offerings for the temple from the outside ones. until the Gemara says that there was an elder who was versed in Chachma Yevani, Greek wisdom, who basically came up with a plot to mess this all up. You know, despite their war, they had like a cooperation agreement to bring offerings into the temple. And he one day decided, this elder, that he was going to whisper into Greek to someone that, you know, if you really want to get these Jews or these other Jews, you should, instead of giving up your, like, I don't know, flower offerings or your cow offerings, you should send a pig up instead. Yeah. And so they send this pig up, and it ends up turning into this whole disaster, and they end up killing each other, and it gets bad. And when that all happens, you know, it's a story, like, only the Gemara could, I don't know, it's a crazy story. When that happens, I don't know if it's the sages or the people of that era. Let's find that. If you're looking in source 6, it's like the third new paragraph. It starts with when the sages saw this, maybe like 10, 15 lines down.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see that?
Mm-hmm.
So Rachel, could you take us from there when the sages saw this?
When the sages saw this, they said at that time, cursed is the person who raises pigs, and cursed is the person who teaches his son Greek wisdom.
Okay. So parenthetically, this is where the prohibition of Greek comes from. And now the Talmud is not talking about Greek language, it's talking about Greek wisdom. Parenthetically, this is also where we get a rabbinic decree that even though, according to the Torah, you shouldn't eat pigs, but you can raise them, there seems to be this rabbinic curse that we follow today that no good Jewish boy or girl should become a pig farmer. We're washing our hands of the swine. Okay. In addition to that, though, there seems to be this curse or prohibition that's made. And this is the Gemara's explanation for where the Mishnah's prohibition of studying Greek comes from, to not study Greek, because it led to this really terrible incident during the Hasmonean period. Okay. That's a problem, because we know that there were lots of prominent rabbis later who did study Greek. For example, I'm going to skip ahead here. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi says... I'll have Rachel. Can you read the next paragraph?
The Gemara raises the question: is that so? That did Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi say in Eretz Yisrael, why should people speak the tongue of Syriac, Sursi, Garmay, commonly spoken in Eretz Yisrael? Rather, they should speak either in the sacred tongue Hebrew or in the beautiful tongue of Greek.
Okay, just pause there. A few points. Who is Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi? No pressure. So he is the most prominent rabbi of the Mishnah period, or one. He's up there. He's the one who compiles all the Mishnah in 200 of the Common Era. So he's a big deal, right? He's not just any rabbinic. He's not just any rabbi of the Mishnah. He's the rabbi who put it all together, and. In addition, so that's kind of point number one I wanted to mention. Point number two is that we have Rabbi Steinsaltz's commentary, which are the non-bold words. But what the original language of the Gemara here says is that you should either, what Rabbi Yehuda Nasi's recommendation is, good Jews living in Israel should speak one of two languages. They should speak Hebrew or they should speak Greek. And Rashi asks, what's special about Greek? And Rabbi Steinsaltz kind of puts in his language, Greek is very beautiful. There's a rabbinic assumption that Greek, after Hebrew, is the most beautiful of the languages. It's elegant. I don't know. It's the French of its era. Something like that. I'm not saying that just because I speak French. I think there's an episode in The Matrix where, like, yeah, c'est une belle langue.
Rabbi, is it true that there are parts of the Talmud that are written in Greek? There was one novelist. Who was the one who wrote The Chosen?
Chaim Potok?
I think he says that in one of his
There's definitely Greek words in the Talmud. May even be Greek words in the Bible. I don't know that there's like a tractate or a chapter that's written in Greek. Oh, we're getting there. Okay, we're getting there. That's next up. Okay, so the Gemara basically has now just leveled a contradiction, right? Because the Mishnah says you should not study Greek. You shouldn't study Greek. And now Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi is quoted as saying, you should speak Greek. If you can't speak Hebrew, that's the next best option. Right? Who are these like Jews speaking Aramaic? What's Aramaic? Like 2,000 years later, it's kind of a big deal. But like if you want to kind of cut your teeth in a yeshiva setting, you basically have to understand some level of Aramaic until Art Scroll and Rabbi Steinsaltz's Talmud become translated in Hebrew and English and every other language. But Aramaic's a big deal now. But Rabbi Yehuda Zanasi is saying, like, that's just a lowly language. If Greek is really where it's at, like if you're going to study other languages. Okay, so how do we resolve that difficulty? Steve, do you mind taking it up from there? Where the Gemara answers that there is a difference. In source 6, about 2/3 down.
Okay. The Gemara answers that there is a difference. The Greek telling is discreet, and the Greek wisdom is discreet. The sages prohibited the latter, but not the former.
So I'll just make you pause there. The Hebrew there is that Yevanit Lechud, the Chachmat Yevanit Lechud. That the Gemara is saying there's a separation or a difference between the language and the wisdom. So the language is okay. That's why Rabbi Yehuda Nasi encouraged people to speak it. But the wisdom, the philosophy, that's not okay. Which leads to the Gemara's next question. Keep going, Steve.
The Gemara poses a question, and is Greek wisdom prohibited? But didn't Rav Yehuda say that Shmuel said the name Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel? What is the meaning of that which is written, my eye affected my soul due to all the daughters of my city?
Don't get caught up in the verse here. Just kind of keep on the 30,000-foot level as we're about to go through this.
There were 1,000 children in my father's house, prince's household, 500 of them learned Torah, the other 500 learned Greek wisdom, yet there only remained of them, after the Bar Kokhba revolt, me, here in Eretz Yisrael, and the son of my father's brother who lives in Asia Minor.
Okay, so we're just pausing 1 second. Okay, what's the point here? We need to know who Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, who is he? He is the Nasi. He's the prince, the chief political leader, and the chief Talmud scholar, or Torah scholar, of the land of Israel. And his father was the prince. He inherited that position, being the chief political leader in the land of Israel, from his father. And he's saying, in my father's house, aka in his Beit Midrash, in his school, there were 1,000 students, and they were split up into two groups. One half of them studied Torah, and the other half of them, it sounds even to the exclusion of Torah, studied Greek philosophy, Greek wisdom. So how could you say that Greek wisdom is forbidden if the chief rabbi of the land of Israel back then, this is during the Bar Kokhba revolt, so when was the Bar Kokhba revolt?
Second century,
134 Common Era, right? How could you say that it's prohibited to study Greek wisdom if the chief rabbi's own household studied Greek wisdom? And so that's the next question. And what's the answer that the Gemara in Masechet Sota and Tractate Sota gives? Keep on going.
The fact that Rabbi Gamliel allowed half of his household to study Greek wisdom indicates that it is permitted. Gemara answers, the members of the house of Rabbi Gamliel are different. They were close to the monarchy and therefore had to learn Greek wisdom in order to converse with people of authority.
Okay.
By necessity.
So great. If you're going to read this source in Masechet Sota and Talmud, what might be the heter, the leniency, the permission to study Greek wisdom?
If you're rich.
If you're rich, okay.
If you need it, yeah. If you need it to make a living. Or
yeah. The rabbis who are looking back at this, they're assuming that you shouldn't do it. Mm-hmm. And they're also working with the knowledge that lots of Jews did. Right? And so now they're trying to kind of explain what... either this is like down the cuffs, so they're trying to judge meritoriously and find some plus for why this was necessary. But we see a few things. One, it was happening, right? Like it or not, it was happening. And we have lots of other examples of this also. Two, why is it happening? It seems here that the way I've read this Gemara is that it's sometimes it's a necessary evil, right? In an ideal world, you should be studying Torah day and night. That should be all of your effort. But push comes to shove, if you're parenthetically a Jew living in a Roman-controlled land or in a land controlled by, let's say, others, you should be familiar with what their wisdoms are so that you can interact with them. I know Romans aren't the Greeks, but okay. I think there's a point of necessary, studying of outside material. Do it when you have to, but not because you want to. It seems to be like one approach that's being put forward in the Talmud. Okay, the other thing I just want to point out now, and Joan mentioned this before, and there's never enough time, so we're going to have to start skipping things and just mentioning them outside. Tractate Megillah, I'm going to refer to Source 7 now, but I'm going to just share pieces of it outside. Tractate Megillah refers to what seems to be a crazy suggestion in the Talmud, which is that it's permitted to write a Torah scroll in Greek. Let that set in for a second. It's like a crazy suggestion.
What is the time period of that suggestion?
It's quoted from a Brita, so we're talking about the Mishnaic era period, so something between 0 and 200.
Isn't that when it was done in Cairo?
Okay, so just to clarify, the suggestion in the Torah is not to write a translation. Not to write, this book that you have on your shelf that is a reference guide to understand the scroll that's in your ark. Right? The suggestion made in the Talmud is you can actually have a kosher Torah
write
scroll.
Write the ark in Greek?
Sorry?
Write the scroll in Greek.
Maybe there's a suggestion in the Gemara that maybe you can actually write the scroll in Greek, which we don't accept as a practical matter. But the suggestion is made, and that brings the rabbis to thinking about, associative thinking. Oh, by the way, we actually have a lot to say about the Torah not being written in Greek on the actual scroll, but being translated to Greek. And then the Gemara goes and tells us the story of the Septuagint. The Septuagint, according to rabbinic tradition, was basically there was this king, Ptolemy in the Hebrew, Ptolemy, I don't know if I can pronounce it properly, I think who was one of the Greek kings who first conquers the land of Israel. Okay. Oh, great. So that actually kind of makes sense because...
It's just a title. So there are several...
It was a dynasty. Greek.
Right. I looked it up.
One of the dynasties that succeeded Alexander's rule was the Ptolemaic dynasty. And then the Seleucid in Syria.
Yes. Okay, so that actually makes sense. Thank you. I looked it up on Wikipedia really quickly because I couldn't remember. So I think this is like right after the Greek Empire breaks up into little pieces, and there's a bunch of Jews living in Egypt outside of Israel. This is probably like, the 100 or 200 years before the turn of the millennium. And they're living in Egypt, and Ptolemy, who's the ruler of Egypt, brings, and this is the story that says, 72 sages into 72 different rooms and commands them all to translate the Torah to Greek because he has this big library. I think the libraries of Alexandria are famous for hundreds of years to come, that they translated every great work. Parenthetically, 1,000 years later, when Maimonides is starting to read the Greek works, where he's getting them from those same libraries where works of Plato and Aristotle had been translated to Greek. So like we know these libraries were very important for lots of different reasons, and one of these kings wants the Torah to be translated like all the other books, right? If you're a rabbi and you're living as a minority in a foreign land, and persecution is definitely an issue, and religious debate is very much a hot button issue of the, you know, I don't know, 2,000 years of exile, right? One of your concerns, if you're asked to translate the Torah, is what about all those difficulties in translation? For example, the first one that's offered here in the Talmud is, if you're going to translate the opening three words of the Torah, Bereshit bara Elohim. Bereshit means beginning, bara means created, Elohim, God. So I might read that as, there's something known as Bereshit, some force known as Bereshit, that created some other force named Elohim. Right? What am I going to do there? And so the Talmud records that there was a miracle that happened, that all 72 rabbis in separate locked rooms intuited the same kind of translation of the Torah into Greek that would avoid all of these potential heretical readings of the Torah. And so they all translated instead as Elohim bara Bereshit, that God created in the beginning, that putting God first. And the Gemara here actually goes through like five or six different examples of changes that they all made in their Septuagint translation, all 72 of them in different rooms, all at the same time. It was a miracle. And they translated the Torah to Hebrew. The Gemara continues to say, like, why is this God's will, basically? Like, why should this be God's will that the Torah is translated to Greek? There's a really, really strong rabbinic feeling that the written Torah, which is the Bible itself, should never be altered, should never be touched, should never be translated. Like, what gave them permission to do it? And they quoted a verse from Genesis that Yafat Elohim LeYefet VYishkon BeOlei Shem, that God has done nicely, or God has enlarged the tribe of Yefet, and he will dwell in the tents of Shem. And Yefet is, according to the Torah, one of the descendants of Yefet. Of Yafet is Yavan, is Greek, Greece. And basically they interpret that Yafet is one of the descendants is Greece, but there's other descendants. So how do you know something special about Greece? Greece is the most Yafet, is the most beautiful. And so the most beautiful of the tribes of Yafet will live in the tents of Shem. What is a tent of Shem a reference to? We're the descendants of Shem. That's why Semites, we're Semites from the people of Shem. In Hebrew, anti-Semitism is anti-Shemiyut, and those who are against the Semites. So what do we learn from this verse? That the beauty of Greeks will live in the tent of Shem. Tent is code word in rabbinic tradition for Torah, for study halls. Because when it says Jacob was a dweller of tents, the rabbinic tradition is that he was studying Torah in the tents, right? Whenever you see tent, that's like kind of code word for Torah study. Okay, so there's this kind of concept that there's something special about Greek and Torah, and it's basically willed by God. And that seems to be really nice, like, great. The wisdom, maybe not so great, but at least, the language is pretty good. Like, let's keep that. As opposed to the Mishnah and Sota that we saw at the top of the last page, which said there's actually a prohibition of studying the language. So we're continuing to see contradictory statements, and to even give one more, in a scary Mishnah in Tractate Sanhedrin at the bottom of the third page, source 8. We're not all going to read all of this before. It starts with this beautiful language that we have quoted at the beginning. It's the introduction to every chapter of Ethics of Our Fathers, that all of Israel has a share or portion in the world to come. And that's like the nice part of the Mishnah. And then there's the but, or the except part. Except if you don't believe in X and Y and Z, and you can read it for yourselves in your own time. One of the statements there, Rabbi Akiva, it's six lines down. Rabbi Akiva says, who also falls into the exception clause? And the answer is, Av HaKora Basfarim HaChitzonim. One who reads outside books has no portion in the world to come. Okay. What's an outside book?
I'm doomed.
So, well, me too. Okay. We're all doomed to, depending on how we read this, we're all doomed. And we're not the first ones to have dealt with this question. We'll get through it together. I think we'll hold each other back from falling into the pits. Okay. What's an outside book?
Greek.
Okay. So this is the first time today that we're not going to be talking specifically about the Greeks. There's two opinions. One is quoted in the Jerusalem Talmud, and then that's also quoted in the Babylonian Talmud with another one. So the one that's quoted in the Jerusalem Talmud is the book of Ben Sira. The book of Ben Sira, are you familiar?
Mm-hmm.
It's a book of proverbs, of expressions, that was written during the late biblical period. And we actually have, the Talmud talks about what books made it into the Bible and what books didn't, which books were canonized and which ones weren't. And the Talmud says Ben Sira was not canonized. It was left out. And there seems to be this fear afterwards that why was it left out? Maybe it says teaches you something heretical, but there's other books that may also teach you heretical stuff. So it's a longer conversation why it doesn't make it in. One opinion is in the Jerusalem Talmud and also in the Babylonian Talmud. If you want to see it, it's top of source, top of the fourth page, source 9. Sheldon, I think you're up for the reading.
Rabbi Akiva says, also one who reads external literature has no share in the world to come. Sages taught in Baraita. This is a reference to reading the books of heretics. Rabbi Yosef said, it is also prohibited to read the book of Ben Sira due to its problematic content.
Okay. So let's start with the second answer from Rabbi Yosef, and that's the only answer quoted in the Jerusalem Talmud. This is the Babylonian Talmud that we just read. That there's something about this one book, just stay away from, don't deal with it. If you deal with it, you may, maybe you could read this as, it's not that it's like going, that reading a word from a book is going to magically put you in the portion of those who don't get a share in the world to come, but maybe you'll get confused, you'll lose your principles of faith, you'll basically start believing heretical beliefs that, according to the Mishnah earlier, already says if you believe some things, or if you don't believe other things, you may not have a share in the world to come. It's kind of like if you don't buy into this vision of religion, you may not benefit from the benefits of that religion, which might involve the world to come. We can talk more about that another time. Steve, in addition to Ben Sira, I want to talk about the books of heretics, because that's the answer that the Babylonian Talmud adds. Book of Heretics, the original Hebrew language is Sifrei Minim, the books of the Mins. So what that probably means is the early proto-Christian books. I don't know if it's talking about the early New Testament, or the earlier books of the New Testament, but there seems to be some literature that's being written by the followers of Jesus, maybe his apostles, who is viewed to be problematic, and you should not touch it. So if I were just to take kind of these two pieces, it seems to be what the Mishnah is saying, or at least this is my interpretation of the Gemara, that there are some things that are just so risky theologically, they shouldn't be touched, right? Mm-hmm. Some things are just too dangerous to let the average I think even the average person just go there. But it doesn't. It's not a rejection of everything that is spoken of, you know, outside of the Jewish libraries. Like, I think you can separate things into three categories. There's Torah, right? That's really good. And then there's like the heretical stuff, and maybe that's really bad. And then there's this category of literature in the middle, and that probably depends on what you want to do with it, right? And so, where does this take us, or you know, what can we think about all this? Well, first of all, you know, there's 1,000+ years of rabbinic tradition of rabbis and very prominent scholars who did study outside works. So, you know, the conversation doesn't end with the Talmud. And so we know that Rabbi Rav Sadia Gaon in the 900s, and probably most famously Maimonides writes an entire volume called The Guide of the Perplexed, which is basically an attempt to bring to peace Aristotelian philosophy with traditional Judaism, right? So he's the first one to do that. What's the point here? So you could take one approach, which is probably like a more conservative reading of all of these texts, to say that when is it okay to deal with the middle grounds, to study this stuff that, you know, may not be absolute heresy, but on the other hand, or maybe even you can study heresy, and like when is it acceptable to do that? And that's the Mishnah in source 10. Da mashitashi veta apikoras. Know how to respond to a heretic. So there's one kind of approach here in all of these, all of this wisdom, is like, study it when it's necessary for your survival. If you need to know how to respond to an outside heretical claim, and therefore you need to study what that claim actually is, okay, then like you're given dispensation, you can now start studying outside materials. I think there's a group of people who very much hold to that. You know, there are large swaths of Jews who will never study literature, modern literature, who will never study social commentary. Pick your poison. There are people who spend their entire lives in a yeshiva setting where they're only going to study, Torah, Tanakh, if that even, and mostly Talmud for their entire lives. There's another school of thought, and I think it's kind of, the Rambam is definitely a champion of that, but it goes far past the Rambam. Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch is another example. The one who I'm personally most influenced by is Rabbi Abram Isaac Cook, Rav Cook, the first chief rabbi of pre-Israel-Palestine, who very much adopted an approach that there's no kind of clear boundaries between Kodesh and Chol, between holy literature and mundane literature. That, of course, Torah is the holiest, but it's not a factor, it's not like there's like a bifurcation, and you either make it into this category of holy or you're separated out for it. For Rav Cook, there's basically two categories. There's the holy, and there's everything else which has not yet been revealed to be holy, but is actually kind of holy underneath. And just one example of that, he has many, many teachings on this lines. I didn't translate the top line, which is kind of, this is source 11. This is how he basically like has a title for this paragraph called Hachol Ba'aspa Klaria Shel HaKodesh, seeing the mundane through the prism of the holy. We can just read a little bit of it right now. Wolf, do you want to read source 11? And then I'll do some of it in Hebrew.
One of the manners of the revelation of the secrets of the Torah in the world is to look at the look also upon the mundane, upon the lens of the holy, to know that in reality there is no true
earthliness
in the world.
Okay, so I'll just read it again in Hebrew, in translate, because Rav Cook is not just a philosopher, not just a Jewish thinker, but also really like a poet. He wrote poetry, and his Hebrew is just absolutely incredible. So he says, "Achat me'atzudot shel hitzgalut razei Torah ba'olam hazeh." And one of the approaches of revealing the secrets of Torah in this world is lahashkif gam alachol mitoch haspa klaria shel hakodesh, is to look also upon things that you think to be mundane from the prism that the assumption that they're holy. Ladat she'ein be'emet chol muchlap olam, to know that in truth there is nothing that is truly mundane in this world. That, this is definitely a more mystical, Kabbalistic approach. The Zohar has a famous line that's going back, 900 years earlier, according to some, going back to the times of the Mishnah, Zohar, the Book of Splendor, which is probably one of the most important Kabbalistic texts, that late atar panoi mineh, I think that's the language in the Zohar, that there's no sphere that is free of God's presence. Like God is to be found everywhere. And Rav Cook kind of takes that idea, which is also expressed in Isaiah in chapter 11, which is that's the famous prophecy of the lambs lying next to the lambs lying next to the lion. In the Messianic times, one of the verses in that prophecy is Kimala ha'aretz de'at Hashem kamayim lamayam lechasim, that the world will be filled with the knowledge of God just as water covers the ocean bed. That there's going to be this kind of overwhelming flow of godliness that will find God in everything. And for Rav Cook, it's kind of the job of each and every one of us to find God in every part of our lives, in every part of existence, and in every form of knowledge and wisdom. And if you want to just look at some of the history, I just quoted a little part for you later, that this gets Rav Cook into trouble because he was the chief rabbi first of Jaffa and then of Israel. And for those who are familiar with the history of modern Israel, starting in the 1700s and 1800s, you have a group of ultra-Orthodox Jews coming from Europe who are very much not of that school of thought. And so they create the old Yishuv, the old settlement, mostly around Jerusalem, and their schools are very, very anti-secular. They don't teach anything modern. And Rav Cook all of a sudden becomes chief rabbi of a school system that happens to teach science and happens to teach evolution, right? And happens to teach other languages. And Rav Cook, you can just see a short quote on the top of source 12, that in his own work, he He says that it's kind of our job, quote, to discover a light of holiness in all the languages and wisdoms of the world.
And who wrote that? I'm sorry.
That top quote is from Rav Kook, and then the paragraph the paragraph underneath it is Bitsalna Orr's description of the history, basically how that got him into trouble. And I think a modern Orthodox approach to these kinds of questions, for me, the most compelling one is this approach from Rav Kook, which is that, you know, it's up to us to find the holiness in all spheres. Just an example of someone who's been doing this recently, and I think I mentioned it before. There was a famous rabbi who passed away about 10 years ago in Israel. He's becoming more famous outside of Israel now, known as Rav Shagar, which is an acronym for Shimon Gershom Rosenberg. And his whole thing, his whole approach was basically that he felt that young Jews, he was ahead of a bunch of religious institutions, a bunch of schools, felt that postmodernism had kind of become an inhibiting factor for the belief of most Jews. Because in a world where no knowledge is absolute and nothing can be proven, and the only knowledge that one can really have is just their subjective understanding of the world that comes from within themselves. I don't know if I'm doing a very fair description of what postmodernism is.
That's good.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
So how can you believe in an absolute faith in religion or in God? How does one believe in an absolute truth of religion in an age where there are no absolutes? And he wrote multiple volumes about basically integrating postmodernist thought with traditional Judaism. And in one of his introduction, in one of the introductions he writes to his books, he basically said, that's Rav Shagar. His works are starting to be translated into English. I can send you an essay later if you'd like, that summarizes some of his thinking. And in one of his introductions, he says, I'm not doing anything new. Right? This is what Rav Kook did with modernism 80 years before me, and this is what Rambam Maimonides did 850 years before that. That it's basically our role to take... There's benefits to taking the wisdom that is common in our day and not to reject it and not to fight against it, but to reveal the holiness that it can be found and brought in from within it. And I think we can each do that in our own way as well. So it's a little bit to say about Jews and the wisdom of the other. And next time we'll finish our four-part series with our responsibilities to the other.
Yeah. We don't want a discussion about the place of the Greek language. I just want to say that David Ben-Gurion taught himself ancient Greek so he could read Plato in the original.
He's a student of Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, I guess. All right, fantastic. Yashikacher, and thanks for coming.
Thank you.